CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're on air with the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. As usual, I'll be your host for the next hour. My name is Kingsley Kipuri. I'm joined in studio by my usual brother in arms, Greg Nicholson. Always good to have you with me. Greg, I think you're following the cricket, man. I hear some really exciting stuff is happening over there.
This is just because I'm Australian. You think I like cricket.
Man, it's going down, dude. He took 100 wickets and he got 10 balls.
Who was that?
Kagiso Rabada.
Okay.
I'm all over this, man. Okay, now let's actually talk about things that we know a bit more about. We'll be talking on a few stories from around the country.
Around the world, actually.
Around the world. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Firstly, talking about police brutality and protests in Ethiopia. There were plans to extend the municipal boundaries of Addis Ababa, and those plans have been met with a lot of backlash, and there's a lot of protesting, and some people reported dead there. So it's quite worrying and something to really watch. Secondly, it's the 5th anniversary of the Arab Spring. So we're going to look back at that, you know, really, really momentous occasion a couple of years ago and look at what things are like now. Various countries were involved. A lot of that happened and was centered around Egypt. So we're going to be touching on that specifically and look at how things stand now. And lastly, we're going to be looking at lead poisoning, what I mistakenly called LED poisoning before. It's actually lead poisoning from water in Flint, Michigan.
I like the idea that it could be LED poisoning as though there are TVs in the Flint, Michigan River.
I mean, televisions are the devil, man. So it's very possible. So we'll be looking at that. And, you know, I've been seeing a lot of rappers donating water. So, you know, maybe that's something to... That's not important.
Sure. Has also donated something like 150,000 bottles of
Big
water.
Sean. So, you know, everybody's coming out. If you want to talk to us, tweet us at DMShowZA. You can call us on 0861-555-189, but just don't call us when we're talking to somebody else because then it'll be weird. Anyway.
That's not that weird.
Time to get to it. First, we're going to be talking about Ethiopia. As I mentioned, there were plans to extend the boundaries of Addis Ababa into the neighboring region, and that's really caused a lot of issues. So we'll be talking to somebody who knows a lot more about this. I think we have him on the phone now. Felix Horn, the Horn of Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. Felix, can you hear us?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect. Sorry, I know the time difference is a bit cruel, but thank you for making time for us.
Sorry, say again?
I'm saying thanks for joining us, Felix.
It's good to be here.
Okay, perfect. So just to start with, I mean, we've seen, you know, since, you know, sort of last year, we've seen protests and some people being reported dead from this extension of the boundaries of Addis Ababa. So it seems like something that just sort of a municipal thing, and it's happening and it's causing such an uproar. So could you just explain to us what's going on with this extension and why is it causing so much sort of uproar and protesting?
Yeah, so since November, we've seen these large-scale protests sweep throughout Oromia, so Ethiopia's largest region. And ostensibly, what the protests were about when it started was that this municipal boundary expansion of Addis Ababa would lead to the displacement of Oromo farmers. And as farmers have experienced in different parts of Oromia, that displacement usually occurs without any compensation whatsoever and without any consultation about the lost land and the lost livelihoods. So that's sort of how it started, and then over time, as the security forces cracked down against those peaceful protesters, the protests have become about so much more.
So why would there be an intention to displace the farmers and take their land? Why would the state or the government do this, and why do you think what's behind this, what is being said as a sort of consistent displacement of these farmers?
Well, Ethiopia's GDP is growing rapidly, and everything about Ethiopia right now is about development. The government's very fond of promoting its development successes. The state-run media is just filled with images of you know, shiny buildings and new roads. Mm. And the individuals that live on those lands where this sort of industrial expansion is happening are just kind of seen as an externality. So, okay. You know, the government wants to promote agriculture that results in exports of different commodities. They don't want to promote sort of the smallholder food security that has been the mainstay of Oromo farmers for generations. So they're just seen sort of an externality, something.
I feel the weight of responsibility enormously, not some
economic growth.
And what's your thoughts, just based on your research? What is your thoughts on this trade-off we're seeing in Ethiopia between development and rapid economic growth versus the human rights and the freedom of speech and in this case, even some of the livelihoods of some of the surrounding farmers?
Well, I think what we have to realize is that this growth that they're talking about, I mean, it's not sustainable. When you have a government that promotes development and you have a population that's rising up because they're not receiving the benefits of development, it's just not sustainable. I mean, although there's little doubt that Ethiopia is making significant economic gains, you know, what we see on a daily basis is we interview all kinds of people who've been forced to flee Ethiopia because they were arrested for questioning development, or they were arrested because they demanded compensation, or they were displaced from their lands. They had no way to feed themselves, so they fled the country, or they're living. Many of them are working as laborers on the farms, the commercial farms that they formerly grew food on. So if Ethiopia cares about long-term sustainable economic growth, it will begin involving local communities as partners in development rather than just seeing them as sort of an obstacle to be dealt with to pursue their economic agenda.
Felix, somewhere I think we saw the statistic that as many as perhaps 150,000 farmers in the Oromo region have been moved off their land over the last 10 years. Is that statistic accurate? And what actually happens to these farmers when they're moved off their land? Where do they go? What do they do after that?
Yeah, it's difficult to know the exact number of individuals that have been displaced in the last number of years, largely because it's very difficult to go on the ground in this country. The moment an international NGO does this, their researchers are targeted, the people they talk to are arrested. Local NGOs have been severely suppressed. There's very few local NGOs that can do that kind of research. And independent media has a very difficult time in Ethiopia, too. So it's very difficult to ascertain the accuracy of that number. But it's very clear that there are significant amounts of farmers in Oromia and elsewhere who are being displaced for the economic growth. Most of those farmers go to live in other parts of the country with relatives and just kind of eke out a living. Mm. We hear a lot of reports of others who are offered jobs as watchmen or laborers on the land that they previously owned. And a lot of people flee the country and live as refugees in neighboring countries.
I hear you, and we're seeing just so much protesting happening. I've been just reading the research and the reports, and it sounds like a lot of the protests and opposition is coming from students. So I'm curious if you could just tell us a bit about the role of sort of young people and students in the protests and the sort of anti Addis Ababa extension movement.
Yeah, so in the early days of the protest, it was elementary school students, it was secondary school students that were protesting. And since that time, it's spread to involve other members of the Oromo society. But, there were a number of cases where security forces were just firing randomly into crowds. We documented many cases where after the protest, soldiers were going door to door and trying to arrest students who may or may not have been involved in these peaceful protests. And there's a lot of examples of in that attempt to arrest where young children were killed. So certainly this is taking a massive toll on Oromo youth.
And Felix, I've read that Human Rights Watch has estimated that approximately 140 people were killed during the recent protests. If it's so hard to be on the ground, how are you able to get accurate figures from that area?
Yeah, so what the information that we wrote was 140 people were killed according to activists. So we're not suggesting there's 140, but certainly when you look at the information we have managed to gather from individuals we talked to on the ground, individuals that we talked to in neighboring countries who have fled the violence, and from the hundreds and hundreds of social media clips that have been posted online. I mean, I think it's likely 140 is a very conservative number at this point in time.
And we have these students who are quite, I guess, dissatisfied with the government and the trajectory of the development in terms of how they're excluded from that development and being negatively affected. But how is the sentiment, across different sectors of Ethiopian society? Is there sort of a broader challenge to this very strong state that we could see increased protests across different sectors of society? Or are many Ethiopians quite happy with the way that development is, steamrolling ahead?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think the Ethiopian government doesn't allow dissent of any type. So they have various techniques that they use to ensure that people are loyal to the party, that people are members of the ruling party. So there's really no sort of avenue or forum for people to express displeasure with any government policy. And you know, there's many, many examples of individuals arrested just for merely questioning whether or not Ethiopia is on the correct development trajectory. And so what that means is when there's no ability for people to express dissent, you know, there's no independent media, there's no independent civil society that can work these type of issues, then you begin to create the conditions where this sort of large-scale uprising that we're seeing in Oromia can happen. So unless the development trajectory changes, unless Ethiopia, you know, genuinely consults with local communities, I think, yeah, it is something that you could see spread to other parts of Ethiopia. I mean, the most important thing to an Ethiopian farmer, whether it's a Oromo or otherwise, is their land. I mean, it's their identity, it's their culture, it's their means to feed themselves. When you take that away without any compensation, I mean, you're just creating a formula for instability long term.
I mean, absolutely. I'm curious on your thoughts on this particular situation where it sounds like the government's plans to extend the borders of Addis Ababa, you know, have been put on hold or cancelled. Do you see that as a genuine sort of acceptance that the will of the people is against this, or do you just see it as a, okay, this is causing too much trouble, we'll be back in some other form?
Yeah, exactly. I think the first thing is that, I mean, it came too late. By the time that they announced the cancellation of the master plan, I mean, the protests had become about so much more. It had become about the use of excessive force by security forces. It had become about sort of historical Oromo grievances, and those are much more difficult for the government to deal with. So if they had sort of announced the cancellation of the master plan much earlier in the protest, maybe it would have quelled things, but we haven't seen any difference or any significant difference on the ground, both in terms of the protesters and also the reaction of the security forces. It just seems business as usual. The master plan hasn't made any significant difference. The other thing I would say is that with or without the master plan, displacement of Oromo farmers is likely to continue unless the government changes its perspective. And we see displacement of farmers and pastoralists for large-scale industrial operations all across Ethiopia, and in those places there's no land use planned. So the existence of the master plan is not the big issue when it comes to displacement.
I hear you. Felix, thanks so much for giving us the breakdown. It's definitely a story we'll continue to follow and, of course, continue to read your writing and great work on this over at Human Rights Watch. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Okay, perfect. That's us talking to Felix Horn, the Horn of Africa Research at Human Rights Watch, who's done some excellent reporting on what's happening in Ethiopia and the most recent protests that we've seen. If you're just tuning in, it's a Daily Maverick Sean Cliff Central. We're talking about the protests we've been seeing in Ethiopia around the sort of extension of the borders of Ethiopia. Next will be of Addis. That would be something. Imagine if they extended the borders of Ethiopia. That's a different show altogether, isn't it? Anyway, somebody who's a lot more eloquent. We'll be talking to Henok Gabisa, president of the Oromo Studies Association, about this issue. Henok, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Okay, perfect. Henok, I know the time difference is a bit unfriendly. Thank you for making time.
Not a problem. Okay. I appreciate being invited here.
Okay, perfect. Now, Henok, I mean, I'd love if you could, you know, break down for us the demographics and the sort of ethnic background of the Oromo people and how it plays into this situation. So as Felix just mentioned, a lot of this issue is not actually about just the borders of Addis and Oromia. It's actually about the background and the ethnicities of different Ethiopian tribes and cultures. And that's a big reason for why this has been such an explosive situation. So, you know, based on your work at the Oromo Studies Association, if you could just give us the background and how you think it plays into this.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for inviting me. I would like to start with the fact that Ethiopia is ethnically a very diversified kind of country. And among more than 100 million Ethiopian population, the Oromo people constitute more than 50 million, which are the majority in number. And actually, that makes them the strong political and social force, not only in Ethiopia, but also in the Horn of Africa. But for some ironic reason, they were reduced to a political minority and economic minority. And if we see the current demographic makeup of the country, less than 6% of the ethnic group in Ethiopia, which is the Tigray people, possess and own more than 84% of the economy and rule almost all strong political activities and movements in the country, which is the TPLF-led national political system. So the Oromos actually were considered to be the political minority, not only 25 years ago, but so long before 100 years during the long before the time of Emperor Haile Selassie and during Minilik time. So the Oromos have always asked for a self-rule and a local autonomy, which basically represents their own political values and virtues. But that has never been considered in any successive Ethiopian regime. And now, for the last 25 years, which were occupied by the current political system or regime, the problem became more aggravated and exacerbated. And now we are witnessing that Oromo kids and daughters and sons are being massacred on a broad daylight on the street in Oromia just for requesting a constitutionally guaranteed right to, you know, self-rule and self-governance. And also the issue of private property protection or land tenure system, which the Oromos have lived on their own land for so many long time. But again, under the guise or under the shibboleths of development and economic growth, the federal government can easily penetrate into their own land and take their land away and then sell the land, not to the investors, but among its own elites. And then the elites of the regime would resell the land among themselves. And that actually proved that the policy has nothing to do with development and growth, actually. And the and so the current and existing Oromo movement or the hashtag Oromo protest is basically a pro-democratic and pro-development movement, which is trying to express its grievance not only about the master plan, but also a long-standing grievance of the Oromo political and the economic discrimination. So if you see the political prisoners in Ethiopia, more than 90% of the Ethiopian political prisoners is made up of the Oromo. And there is a nominal political party system which is put at the regional level, at the Oromo regional level, which is called the OPIDIO. That OPIDIO regime does not have any political legitimacy for the last 25 years. It is just basically a representative of the national political party within the Oromo. It does not represent the Oromo in the political system, but it represents the political regime within the Oromo, kind of a crony, or you can call it that way. So the Oromo people found themselves in a vacuum where they have to struggle for their life in a peaceful way. But again, very unfortunately, the government responded with a violent and live ammunition. That's why we had all more than 150 students and farmers being shot at on the street, and that's what's happening.
I mean, thanks for the detailed breakdown, Enoch. I mean, that was just, you know, incredible sort of to sum that up in just a few minutes. I mean, it sounds like, you know, you're boiling this down to sort of the relations between the Tigray people who you're saying are, you know, largely overrepresented in terms of land ownership and power and the elite and the Oromo who've been sort of marginalized for so long. So does that mean you just see this extension or this master plan to extend Addis Ababa, but you just see it as a power play and an ethnic power play against the Oromo people rather than a legitimate sort of economic boundary change for economic development?
Well, first of all, I would like to make clear that it's not Oromo people against the Tigray people, but if you see the elites in the current political system, you see them coming from the Tigray area, which actually attempts to paint a figure that the Tigray people are going to be against the Oromo. But the Oromo people understand that they are really against the system, which try to diminish them, because as much as possible, we're trying to control the discourse in a way that the Oromo people are really fighting against a political system which is really unfair and comes from a single ethnic group, which is the Tigray, obviously. But, you know, I just want to make a point that the Tigray people, if they believe in injustice and also if they believe in inequality and justice, they need to denounce what their elites are doing, actually, at the federal level.
Oh, thanks for clearing that up. Now, Henok, I'm curious what you think about this argument that's being made in Ethiopia and some other African countries, that the priority now for Ethiopia is actually development. And the argument is that, you know, there has to going to be have to be a compromise on things like human rights and civil liberty and some of those other things with a strong sole focus on economic development first. What do you say to that sort of argument that the government is prioritizing economic development above other things temporarily?
Nothing is wrong with prioritizing or with having a development as a priority. Yeah. I mean, we like development. But here is the point, though. I mean, people try to argue that development is mutually exclusive to human rights protection. No, development itself is a right. It's a fundamental human right that any human being, not only the Oromo, every human being deserves. For a government to develop a country or a nation or a land or anything, it does not have to interfere or fundamentally violate the rights. Like, here is the point. It's African dictators and leaders who try to paint a picture that for a development to take place, people's rights should be violated. No, development itself is a right. It's a juridical and constitutional right that people deserve. But we're talking, what kind of development? Are we talking about inclusive and sustainable development? Or are we talking about benefiting a certain number of elites who take their money and run away from the country, from the continent? You know, or are we transforming the life of a society, or are we just putting a lot of money or $1 million from one pocket to the other? That is the concept of development that we need to redefine. If we see, for example, let's take South Africa. I studied South African constitution a long time ago, and I know there is a real problem on the ground. But again, at least constitutionally speaking, the 1996 of South African constitution, which really transformed the level of South African life, at least to some extent, is praised among different countries, not for benefiting a single number of people, but at least trying to empower the socio-economic rights of the whole society. You know, we can debate about the implementation of it. Mm. But when you come to the Ethiopia, it is just taking away a land from more than 1.1 million Oromos who live in and around Addis Ababa, and give it to a certain loyal people who are loyal to the elite. Mm. And then these loyal people resell the land and then run away. Here is the point. Long before the policy of the current regime, the Oromo people have always produced their food, and they have never been in any kind of poverty or hunger. But right now, since they started implementing the short-sighted development policy in Ethiopia, the Oromo people fell into poverty, and they could not produce their land anymore. There is a credible data where whenever there is small or medium-level agricultural or farming size, people can feed themselves, not only in Oromia, but anywhere in Africa. But again, because of this land grabbing, basically it's a land grabbing policy, people are reduced and diminished to being a guard for a new settler, and some of their children become shoe shiners for these settlers, and their wife become a housemaid, basically. So can we call this a development? That is the question that every African citizen had to answer these days.
I mean, I hear you. I mean, you know, just listening to all this, I mean, I suppose the big question is, you know, what do you think needs to happen now? I'd love to hear what you think needs to happen in the short term, firstly, just to resolve the current tension that we've seen with the protests. And then secondly, in the longer term, sort of resolve some of the ethnic issues you've raised and sort of some of the poverty then and lack of inclusive economic development that people are experiencing. What do you think needs to happen now?
Well, when it started, the Oromo protest has actually a very simple and brief demand that it put forward to the government. Number one, the Oromo people's right to self-rule and self-determination, which is a local autonomy, should be constitutionally respected. That is not something new. It's something which is already within the constitution, and that should be met by the government, number one. And the other is the Oromo right to private property and a secure land tenure should also be observed and protected by the government. The government has to take its hands off of the Oromo land and let the Oromo people develop themselves. And then the third is the language right, which language and cultural right. For example, I told you that the Oromo people are the majority. They are about 50 million people in Ethiopia. But if you see the federal language, it is not their language because of the language, which is the Amharic. It is the language that does not belong to the Oromo. the Oromo students, when they graduate from college and university, they cannot get a job in the federal. So there is not enough amount of Oromos represented at the federal level in any public service. So the majority of the people, which are the Oromos, should have their language being recognized as a national working or official language, just as equal as Amharic, so that Ethiopia can have a multiple language, right? So it's also about the existential threat that is posed to the Oromo should also be mitigated by the government. So I personally see that the government suspended the master plan or canceled the master plan a couple of days ago. Yep. But again, there is a reason to doubt this. First of all, without a master plan, always the government has done land grabbing phenomena or scenario in the country. And the master plan was the immediate cause. It was not a fundamental cause. Take, for example, in Gambela area, there was not a master plan when the people of Gambela were violently dislocated and dispossessed, right? And also the master plan was not in existence in early 2000s when the Oromos were violently dislocated from their land. There are already laws which really expropriate the Oromo land without any kind of compensation long time ago before the master plan. So the master plan is basically it's a facade or kind of document that tries to bring something new to the people under the umbrella or under the disguise of urbanization development. So the people have a reason not to believe that without the existence of the master plan, the intention of the master plan keeps going on. So the last thing that the government has to do is to reinstitute the confidence or the legitimacy that it already lost. To be quite frank with you, in the Oromia region, having 10,000, more than 10,000 people being imprisoned and their leaders like Bakale Garba being imprisoned, the government has already lost a legitimacy. It's very difficult for this regime to regain back that legitimacy. And the Oromo people have always seen this regime as an equivalent apartheid kind of regime in Oromia for the last 25 years. So it's a very tough situation right now.
Henok, I hear you. We really appreciate your work at the Oromo Studies Association publicizing these issues and, giving us the important context. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have, but we'll make sure to come to you in the future as the story continues to play out.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it for being invited here.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. If you're just tuning in, it's a Daily Maverick show on Cliff Central. If you're just joining us, we were talking about some of the issues going on in Ethiopia around the extension of Addis Ababa's regional borders.
I was going to say it's a fascinating issue because Ethiopia, despite its track record on human rights, which has seen protesters and dissenters detained, it doesn't have a free media or a free press. It is hailed as one, as along with Rwanda, which also has its own human rights issues, it's hailed as one of the African sort of economic success stories, at least. And Simon Allison, who we have frequently on the show, spent last year, I think, 3 or 4 months living in Addis. And he said it's fascinating being there, just seeing how much is done, how efficient the Ethiopian government is. But the question I think that's always happened with fast developing states is at what cost, and how do you find that balance between development and exclusion? And in this case, I think they're not finding that balance.
I mean, absolutely. We asked Enoch just now, and he was just like, "That's not." That trade-off is just a mythical trade-off. This development is not inclusive. It's just not happening.
And clearly, I think the government doesn't care about that either. That is not their key focus at the moment. The key focus is development.
Absolutely. Daily Maverick Show, cliffcentral.com. Remember, you can tweet us on @DMShowZA. You can call us on 0861-555-189.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
If you're just joining us, we're going to be switching topics and talking about the Arab Spring. It's been 5 years since we saw that sort of momentous sort of wave go across sort of North Africa and the Middle East area. And we'll be talking to somebody who's, award-winning journalist who's covered the Egypt Revolution for The Guardian and has just released his first book, The Egyptians, A Radical Story. And it's written also on South Africa and some local issues too, so he might weave that in. I'd like to introduce Jack Schenker. Jack, can you hear us?
I can. Thank you for having me on.
Fantastic. Jack, congratulations on the book.
That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Jack, it's Greg here. How are you doing?
Hi, Greg. I'm well. How are you?
Good. Good to hear from you again. We may as well jump straight into it. And you were on the ground, am I correct, when I think it was 25 January 2011, the protest in Egypt started in Tahrir Square.
That's right, yes. It began with 18 days of uprising against Hosni Mubarak and then morphed into basically 5 years of almost non-stop unrest.
If we look at those sort of that start, those 18 days, you know, when I think watching around the world, like we all of a sudden started hearing sort of murmurings of this thing of the Arab Spring. Everyone heard this phrase, we're all Khalid Sayed, I'm not sure how to say it properly.
Khalid Sayed.
What was it like actually being there on the ground and seeing it all, witnessing it all happening?
Well, I wrote a piece recently trying to kind of marshal my memories of that period. And I entitled it The World Turned Upside Down, because to be honest, it felt like our own personal worlds were being turned upside down, and it felt as if the wider world was being turned upside down. I've never lived through anything quite like it. It was the most terrifying and the most exhilarating and the most inspiring period of my life, certainly. And speaking to many, many Egyptians on the ground, not just those that were out protesting in the streets, you know, building barricades and fighting the police to reclaim urban space from Mubarak's state, but even Egyptians who stayed at home and were watching proceedings on the television, they talk about this complete psychological shift. And I think that sense of excitement and that sense of possibility, followed by a very, very crushing, as you know, counter-revolution and a new kind of degree of state repression, the contrast between those two extremes has been particularly emotionally exhausting and very difficult for people to process.
Mm. Now it's, I guess, 5 years on, Egypt is under the government of President Sisi. Many activists are in detention. Protests seem to be effectively banned, am I right? And
yeah,
the Muslim Brotherhood's political wing is also, you know, banned. And it feels, I've read a number of writers sort of looking back at that time in 2011 and saying, sort of feeling almost this great sense of despondency, like the excitement they had back then was premature. But you've written, I think you're writing a piece you did for The Guardian recently was quite interesting, and I assume it sort of reflects some of the tones in your book about the shifts in the factories, fields, urban streets, away [S2] Yes. [S1] From the barricades and the protests we saw on TV. Can you tell us just a little bit about how this sort of revolution has occurred in the minds of people, not just, you know, not just throwing stones on the streets, but across the whole country and in all sort of sectors of society?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the conventional narrative has been that Egypt is a textbook example of revolutionary failure, really, that, you know, it shows that mass protest and popular resistance never achieves anything, and that business as usual politics always wins out in the end. And what I try and do in the book is show that that narrative, although it's very comforting for elites inside Egypt's borders and beyond, is actually profoundly misleading. As you say, the book tries to concentrate not so much on Tahrir Square and kind of those young protesters with their smartphones and their Twitter accounts that the world zoomed in early 2011. Instead, I try to show that the revolution is not something that can be confined in a space like central Cairo or in a time period like early 2011. It's actually part of a far deeper and ongoing historical process in which millions of citizens, not just in Egypt, but right across the Arab world, are rejecting political exclusion, and they're rejecting economic exclusion, and they're rejecting the state violence that goes hand in hand with both. And we're at the beginning of that process. It's bringing together democratic citizens with rulers who cannot and will not change. And that's a fundamental contradiction, which hasn't been settled. This is not game game over, back to square one. And so in the book, what I try and do is I go, as you say, outside of Tahrir to the factories, to the fields, to neighborhoods where communities have been resisting eviction, to poor areas where women who work as domestic cleaners are forming their own trade unions to, you know, fight for their rights. I visit some Bedouins who reclaimed what they say is land stolen from them by the state, and the state is using to build a nuclear power plant. They stormed the site, beat off the army, and reclaimed that land for themselves. Now, some of these developments are transitory. You know, the state has fought back. But what I argue in the book is that it's helping to produce this psychological shift where citizens say, do you know what? You don't have the right to expect unquestioned obedience from me anymore. I'm not going to accept this combination of dire socioeconomic conditions and political powerlessness. I want to muscle my way onto the political stage and have a say over my environment. And that's a psychological shift that has blown through the family dining room and the college lecture hall and the school playground just as much as it has the corridors of government. And I think that is what is going to keep this process of disruption and contestation going.
And it seems sort of an interesting phenomenon linked to, I think, what we're seeing in a number of different societies around the world, which is this sort of fight back or questioning of sort of a neoliberalist capitalism, privatization, and linked to cronyism and political exclusion. It seems to be a part of a broader international self-introspection we're having at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. And the book very much tries to make that point. It argues that, you know, as well as being something that can't be confined in space or time, it's also something that can't be isolated inside Egypt's borders. It's part of a global moment, exactly as you say, in which I think, you know, now 3 or 4 decades of aggressive neoliberal orthodoxy, and obviously South Africa, you know, from the early 90s onwards has been a prime example of that process, has caused a disconnect between citizens and state, that the relentless expansion of private markets, the belief that all social goods are best allocated by market forces, whether you agree with that economic orthodoxy or not, and I personally don't, I think it's undoubtedly true that it's created a huge pressure on old political models, both in the global south and the global north, both autocratic regimes and kind of long-time democracies. All over the world, we're seeing old political models breaking down. We're seeing maverick politicians on both sides of the Atlantic and both sides of the political spectrum rise up. We're seeing institutional chaos in southern Europe. We're seeing the dissolution of borders in the Middle East. Now, all of these things have separate contexts, of course, and individual localized nuances, but I think they're all part of this moment of global transition and global disruption, and Egypt is very much on that moment's front line. And what I try and say in the book is, you know, when we look at the Egyptian revolution, rather than seeing it as something intensely local, something that can be sealed off inside its borders, we actually have to see that it involves processes of governance and of resistance, which implicate us all. You know, this struggle belongs to all of us, and we're all invested in the outcome.
Now, Egypt has gone through so much over the last 5 years. It seems difficult, I imagine, to predict what's going to happen next. But do you sort of play around with different scenarios as what, you know, what might happen next in Egypt?
Well, the only thing that one can definitely say of Egypt is that it will make a fool out of anyone who makes predictions. I mean, in the late 2000s, under the Mubarak regime, before the revolution, you had Western commentators and political analysts saying this: Egypt is essentially a boring country. It's the most populous state in the Arab world. You know, you've got 80, 90 million people who are largely, acquiescent to their dictatorship. And you had international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank saying economic reforms are on the right track. They called Mubarak's economic policies prudent and impressive and bold. You had the American ambassador saying Egyptian democracy is going well. And then 12 months later, you had one of the most the beginnings of one of the most incredible revolutions the world has ever seen. Since then, at every single stage of this kind of revolutionary turmoil, you have had people saying the story is now at an end. We are back to square one. You know, first we had a military rule in Egypt, then we had the rule of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now we're back to an authoritarian dictator once again. And at each of these transition moments, people have said, it's all over. This is the new status quo. And every single time they have been proved wrong, precisely because, as I said before, the Egyptians are unwilling to accept being kind of excluded from the political stage. And I believe that although it's impossible to predict exactly when it will happen or what the spark will be, this current regime, which has made so many promises to its people on account of things like, we're going to fight a war on terrorism, we're going to keep Egypt safe, we're going to provide economic stability, it has failed so far to live up to all of those promises. And it feels the need to use revolutionary rhetoric to establish its own legitimacy. But in the process, it creates a rod for its own back because people can see a gap between the rhetoric and reality. And so I think the more people start asking questions about that regime, the more we're going to see popular protests. We've already seen kind of limited but very, very intense demonstrations in certain cities over police torture, over labour conditions. Last year, we even had the police on strike. We had one section of the security forces tear gassing another. These are all signs of intense vulnerability at the heart of this regime, which is precisely why we're seeing such a huge scale of state repression. So I do think the regime is vulnerable. I think it knows it's vulnerable. And I think it's trying to accumulate as much political and economic control now so that it can hedge against the future struggles on the streets, which it knows are inevitable.
Sorry, Jack, thanks very much. I think that's all we have time for today. Your book is available. I'm not sure if it's available in South African stores yet, but I'm sure you can buy it online, and I'm definitely going to get myself a copy. It's called The Egyptians, A Radical Story. It's published by Alan Lane and Penguin Books. Thanks, Jack, for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
Fantastic. If you're just joining us, the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. We're just going into the last leg of our really, really packed show. We'll be talking about what's going on with the water, what some are describing as a water crisis that's being called by sort of a racist structural situation coming out of Flint in Michigan in the United States. We saw a sort of famous sort of movie maker and director, Michael Moore, who I think is from that specific town, sort of brought a lot of popularity to it, and it's just continued to sort of become something that's being discussed.
No, it's a huge issue in the States at the moment.
And we're just trying to get a hold of one of the sort of big journalists that's reporting on this. Spongile, our producer, is making positive sounds at me, which means we have got him. Okay, time to introduce. Okay, we don't.
Oh,
I know you've been reading a bit about this. If you could just give us a quick overview while we make sure the Skype line is 100%.
First of all, so we're waiting for John Counts. He's a statewide reporter from Michigan's M Live's impact team. He investigates crimes, corruption and other issues. And he just wrote this fantastic article on the whole sort of as to what happened recently. So I think he's with us now.
Fantastic. John, can you hear us?
I can hear you. How are you guys doing?
Good, good. We're just finished introducing you and your incredible work coming out of Flint.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay, fantastic. Now, John, I'd love if you could just, give us sort of a brief overview of what's happening. So, we're here on the other side of the world, and we're just hearing a lot of stories about lead poisoning coming out of the water system, and also sort of reports that this is not just sort of a municipal failure on water supply and service delivery, but it actually has a big race element to it. Could you just tell us what's going on?
Sure. I mean, this dates back several years. Flint is a pretty hard knock town. It's about an hour north of Detroit. And we all know kind of like Detroit's story. And Flint's story is pretty similar. It was a town that survived basically on auto jobs. General Motors was based there. And when they started to pull out back in the day, the city went into economic decline. And it's now it's mostly black and mostly an impoverished town. But they were still on Detroit water. Detroit water covers all of southeastern Michigan. But it came to the point where Flint was pretty much bankrupt, and the state appointed an emergency manager. And that effectively renders the mayor or any other elected officials pretty much powerless. Mm. The emergency manager is pretty much in charge of everything. So back in 2013, they decided to join this pipeline that was going to get their water from someplace different to save some money. And eventually, then it's kind of a complicated story, but they decided to start getting their water from the Flint River.
Okay.
So mm-hmm. when they made that switch from Detroit water to the Flint River water in April 2014, and then immediately after that, residents started complaining about the water quality.
We've seen pictures. It looks yellow, right?
Mm-hmm. So, like, right after they made the switch, you know, residents would show up to city council meetings, and they had, you know, jugs of water, and it was it was discolored, and it tasted bad, and like, you know how when it foams up, didn't foam up because it was so hard. So people were immediately complaining about it, and the state just said, oh, you know, they would test it and be like, you know, it's still good, you can keep drinking it, it's no problem, it's no problem. But you know, it didn't come to light that there was lead in it. Not through governmental testing, but through testing by the Flint residents got so upset that they found a professor from Virginia Tech University who tested the water for them and found out that there were high levels of lead in it. And even then, they still didn't, like, the state did not tell people to stop drinking the water.
How long did it take, John, for the state to actually take these complaints seriously?
You know, amazingly, they just started taking them seriously within the last month. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on for 2 years. They determined that here in Michigan, we have the Department of Environmental Quality, and they're the people who are charged with testing the water. And it turns out that they were using the wrong federal regulations as far as lead is concerned. And so a lot of those people have been fired, and it's, you know, it's kind of a long ongoing saga.
And what's the sentiment of residents now in Flint? How do they feel? I'd imagine they're pretty pissed off.
Oh, they are extremely pissed off. You know, I spent the day out there a week and a half ago when I was working on this story, and I mostly hung out at fire stations where folks were coming to pick up bottles of water, and they'd called in the National Guard, so basically, like, the army is there handing out water, and you know, they're extremely upset. They want the governor here, Rick Snyder, you know, from they want him arrested or fired or at the very least to resign. And they just kind of feel that, you know, the government totally let them down.
I mean, I hear you. I'm curious because, I mean, I suppose now it's just like, it's a failure in service delivery to the people around, and what was supposed to be delivered was not. But I'm curious about the extra consequences of that in terms of what health risks this water and this kind of water quality is posing to the people of Flint.
Sure. So the high levels of lead are they definitely endanger children, and the effects of that will not be known perhaps for years. So that quotient of it sort of remains to be seen. But in the meantime, they just announced within the last few weeks that there have been a spike in deaths in that county, that Flint's in, Genesee County, in Legionnaire's disease. So 10 people have died since the water's been switched over, more or less, from this Legionnaire's disease. And that's a significant spike. They have not been able to conclusively link it to the water switch, but many experts have said that it could be because of that.
Now, John, I think Michigan Governor Rick Snyder has apologized, and also I read that Michigan Department of Environmental Quality Director Dan Wyant has also resigned. But I'd imagine that surely this isn't enough. Will there be anyone else who'll be held accountable for this complete screw-up?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Snyder has apologized, like you said, and the director of the DEQ has resigned. The spokesman, the press guy for the DEQ also resigned. And just recently, the two unnamed employees at the DEQ have also been suspended. I think it's because I'm not sure if they can't yet be terminated or what the deal is, but they haven't been named, but they've been suspended, and I'm sure the governor would want to just fire them, but maybe he can't. And I also know the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, which is like a federal agency, the person who is in charge of this region also has either, I can't remember if they've resigned or if they were terminated or what, but I expect that more heads will roll as we go forward here.
I mean, I hear you. I think what's really been sort of a big question for me is the question of race. A lot of people are saying this is not just about governance and service delivery, but it's about race. And if that the area wasn't predominantly African-American and poor, that the response would have been quicker and very different if Flint was white. What do you say to that?
You know, I'm not allowed to get too much into my opinion, but absolutely. I mean, that's definitely the sentiment of the people in Flint, is that, you know, if this happened in Grosse Pointe or Birmingham, which are very white affluent suburbs of Detroit, the response would have been much quicker and much more aggressive than waiting around and telling people that it's okay, you know. You know, it should be pointed out that Rick Snyder is a Republican, and so this is getting fairly political here in Michigan as well, as far as casting blame and who's defending him and who's going after him, obviously. So, but yeah, I mean, the general sentiment in Michigan is that had this happened in a rich white place, it would have gotten fixed a lot earlier.
I mean, I hear you, John. I mean, we've only got a minute to go, but I'm just curious, what's the ideal situation going forward? What can be done to fix this as soon as possible? What do you think?
You know, it's going to take years to fix is what I'm hearing. They're going to have to replace all the old lead pipes. In the meantime, you know, just if anybody out there can donate some money or bottles of water to the Flint area, I would encourage that, because they're going to need all the help that they can get.
I hear you, John. I was hoping for a more optimistic answer, but the truth is the truth, right? John, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Okay, perfect. Unfortunately, we've just run out of time. Remember, this is the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. You can tune in every week, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. Remember to download and share the podcast far and wide. Big thank you for everyone who came on, and of course to my co-host Greg Nicholson. We'll see you next week.
I'll be here, I guess.
Good. Let's go see what's happening with the cricket. All right, guys. We'll see you next week. Have a good afternoon.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.